Chris Williamson, former Labour MP, Jeremy Corbyn's loudest champion in the parliamentary Labour Party. I was leading a campaign to democratise the Labour Party, to make MPs accountable to the membership, to ensure that we could deliver the socialist programme that Jeremy Corbyn was spearheading. But as a result of that and my support for the Palestinian people, I was targeted, accused of anti-Semitism, or I was accused of facilitating anti-Semitism, actually, not actually anti-Semitism itself. They said I was, what did they say, I was a pattern of behaviour, I think it was. And that was because I was defending people who'd been, you know, unfairly smeared, people like Ken Livingstone and Jackie Walker and various other long-standing anti-racist activists. And I didn't feel it was right to stand by and allow these people to be demonised in that way. And that was then used against me to get me suspended from the Labour Party. And since that time, I've been campaigning on various issues and joined the Workers' Party a few years ago. I'm now the deputy leader of the Workers' Party of Britain.
Now, you're talking about democracy there, Chris, because there's a couple of things that come to mind. First of all, this new chap, Burnham, a new leader, there's been no vote by the Parliamentary Labour Party, nor by the thousands of Labour Party members. He has been selected, and my question is, who has selected him? And secondly, during the Starmer era, there was changes to the party's selection process for MPs, and there's quite a lot of MPs who now are in Parliament, but if you look back to who's behind selecting them, it does appear to be it's almost like the ghost of Peter Mandelson hovering over the party still. So could you just address those two aspects to party democracy, the leadership election or non-election, and the presence still of Mandelson's selected MPs?
Well, we live in a parliamentary democracy rather than a presidential system, and so it's perfectly constitutional for a new prime minister to be selected in the way in which Andy Burnham was. Yes, it's been a coronation. There hasn't been any vote of the membership. But look, the reality is, as a result of what you were setting out there, the fact that Peter Mandelson, Morgan McSweeney, who was Keir Starmer's chief of staff, I mean, they basically oversaw a large proportion of the parliamentary candidates at the last election they selected, and they made sure that there was no kind of last vestiges of any sort of potential Corbyn-style candidate able to put themselves forward. And so consequently, we've now got a parliamentary Labour Party, which is in large measure in the image of Morgan McSweeney and Peter Mandelson. And therefore, there is a dearth of talent, a dearth of people with any real kind of commitment to delivering a progressive agenda in Britain, let alone a socialist one. And so, you know, we're not in a very good place, I think, democratically speaking, because all of the political parties in this country, from Labour through Tory, Liberal Democrat to Reform, are essentially offering the same thing. When it comes to the economy, they're all committed to, in various forms, neoliberal economics. And when it comes to foreign policy, they're all kind of signed up to the war machine and the sort of imperialist agenda, which, you know, unfortunately holds sway over the entirety of the political class. So there's no real difference in that sense. It's kind of tinkering at the edges. And I think Andy Burnham's a nice guy. I knew him from when I was in Parliament from 2010 to 2015. And he's a very likable chap. I got on with him, quite well. He's a personable guy. But he's come from the New Labour stable. You know, he's come from the Tony Blair, Gordon Brown, New Labour era. And he may have moved a little bit. I mean, he's made some interesting comments. For example, he's saying he wants to end neoliberalism, but he's also said he wants to stick to, or he's going to stick to, the fiscal rules, which is neoliberalism 101. He's made some comments about the genocide, although he's not called it that, in Gaza, and said that the Labour Party got that wrong. And he said he's apologised for that. But, he was a former, I don't know if he still is, a former member of Labour Friends of Israel. He said when he was standing for the Labour leadership, when Jeremy got elected the first time around in 2015, I think it was, that his first trip abroad would be to Israel. Now, whether he's moved on from that remains to be seen. But unfortunately, all of the appointments that I am aware of that he's made in terms of his backroom staff all seem to come from that kind of New Labour Zionist sort of stable. And his cabinet is a bit more balanced, but I mean, there aren't that many kind of anybody really. Well, I don't think anybody really qualifies as a proper socialist inside the Parliamentary Labour Party now. But there are some people who are a bit further to the left than some of the people that have been selected. But it's certainly a more balanced cabinet than we had under Keir Starmer. He was very much a right-wing factionalist, pro-Zionist, pro-war guy. And we'll see. I mean, he's saying some good things, but I'm not sure he's putting in place the systems necessary to bring about the change he says he wants to make. And but time will tell. Let's see how things develop over the next sort of few months and years.
Now, the way you're defining the sort of modern politics there is you're using this expression neoliberal economics quite a lot. Can you sort of hone that down to what it actually means and what is, there may be other forms of economics, I'm sure there are, but what is a neoliberal policy and how do you spot it?
Well, essentially, it's a very small state, a very small role for government, and a system which prioritizes the private sector, that believes that the route to economic salvation is through the private sector, the route to economic growth is via the private sector, and that basically government's role is to is to get out of the way and facilitate the private sector. I mean, that's essentially what neoliberalism is all about. And indeed, this kind of approach that we've been living with now for the best part of half a century was initiated really by Dennis Healey back in 1976 when he went to the International Monetary Fund on a false premise. This was shortly after Harold Wilson stepped down as Prime Minister and was replaced by Jim Callaghan. And I think they were bedazzled a bit by monetarism. And so they sort of smoothed the way, if you like, for Margaret Thatcher, because the Chancellor, Dennis Healey, went to the International Monetary Fund on a false premise in 1976
So, what was
for
that
a.
false premise, Chris?
Well, I mean, they basically was well. He claims he was badly advised by his Treasury officials. He subsequently apologised for, for a bit too late by then, actually, and they were worried about the strength of the economy. The pound was under attack, and he went to the International Monetary Fund to, I think, it was borrowed something like $3.9 billion. He never really needed to draw it down, actually. I think he drew part of it, about 50% of it down, but it's all paid back within a couple of years. In fact, before Margaret Thatcher actually came to power in 1979. But it was all completely unnecessary. And he borrowed this money in order to try and defend the value of the currency. That was probably actually a mistake. I mean, this is one of the problems that we've had, and was, I guess, one of the main reasons why our manufacturing industry has been decimated, because Thatcher, when she came to power, inflated, basically falsely inflated the value of the currency, which made British exports more expensive, to people that we were trying to sell our goods into, it led to the demise of our industry. I mean, many of the jobs that used to be done in Britain are now being done overseas, because these international corporations, British-based international corporations, recognise that they could make more money, bigger profits, higher dividends for shareholders by offshoring their operations to lower-waged economies. And I mean, my own city, when I left school in 1972, there's around about 120,000 people working in manufacturing in Derby. Today, it's a fraction of that. I mean, what would they be? Maybe 20,000 or something like that. And that's been reflected really right across the country. As I say, 6 million manufacturing jobs have disappeared over that intervening period of time. And they've been replaced by, low-value Mickey Mouse jobs in large measure, not all of them, obviously, but in large measure. Insecure, precarious employment is now endemic throughout Great Britain. And, the sort of working-class jobs, the working-class kind of security that, we took for granted, my generation took for granted has all disappeared now. So my sort of, children's generation can't look forward now to the security that I was, felt guaranteed, when I was sort of growing up. And indeed, in the 1960s, we were being told to get ready for the leisure generation, and local authorities were being told to build leisure centres and swimming pools and golf courses and tennis courts because and investing in an adult education and so on, because the view was that by the 1990s, early 2000s, a large proportion of the population would have a lot more leisure time on their hands and therefore needed things to occupy them in that sense, and it was John Maynard Keynes who actually made this prediction in 1930, I think he was. He said, the great economist I'm talking about there, John Maynard Keynes, who said that his grandchildren's generation, that's basically people of sort of around about my age, would only be working around 15 hours a week. Well, that was the sort of what we were moving towards. That's why they were saying, get ready for the leisure generation. I remember, programs like Tomorrow's World and stuff was, with this brave new world was being mapped out for us. And unfortunately, that's all dissipated. And it's been done by design. As I say, started sadly by a Labour government and then turbocharged by Margaret Thatcher's administration, Geoffrey Howe. And, his managed decline is what he was talking about, managed decline of great industrial centres like Liverpool and so on. And so, I mean, these people, basically are traitors to the country, if truth be told. They didn't have the national interest at heart at all. The people that they were prioritising were the oligarchs, with the corporate sector, with the super rich. And I mean, this is why we've ended up in a situation now where, inequality is gone into the stratosphere. I mean, the post-war consensus from 1945 through to the mid-1970s, when around about the time actually when Healey went to the International Monetary Fund, economic inequality was narrowing every single year up until that time. A bigger and bigger proportion of the national income was going into workers' pockets, basically into the pockets of the working class in Britain. And but since then, it's been going in the opposite direction. And now, inequality is, we've not known inequality on the scale that it is in Britain now for, well over 100 years, possibly longer.
Yeah, so we've now got a one of the surprises. I mean, you could say it was a surprise. Is that as Chancellor is John Healey, the former Defence Secretary. Now he was one of the earliest to resign. A week, couple of weeks actually, before Donald Trump announced that. And this is one of the ironies of all this, Chris, that it was about 4 hours before it was announced that Keir Starmer was. Going to announce his resignation. Donald Trump announced that Keir Starmer was going to announce his resignation, which makes you wonder either the Americans have been spying on the British Downing Street and listening in to the things that are discussions and Labour Central Office and the NEC, etc., or else maybe the order has come from Donald Trump. Look, you're getting
Well,
rid of this
maybe.
guy. You don't know why. N nobody probably will ever know, but the fact is, the resignation of the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom was announced 3 or 4 hours before in the United States than it was here. And his appointment of John Healey from the Defence Ministry of Defence to be Chancellor seems to be a sort of almost standing to attention and saluting NATO and saying, well, actually, these spending priorities from Mark Rutte and from NATO in Brussels are going to be dominating the Treasury and the Chancellor, and they're going to get their way. So anyway, it's interesting that we've got this different Healey now from the old days, and I wonder if you could say something about what you reckon of the new guy and whether if there's any comparisons to make with the 1970s Chancellor Dennis Healey.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, it certainly seems to be a nod, doesn't it, to Donald Trump, who's been berating other NATO countries and saying that they should increase the amount that they are spending on armaments. And that was certainly, Healey's argument, wasn't it? It was why he, resigned, saying that there wasn't spending enough on weapons of war. I mean, I don't know what's happened to the Labour Party. I mean, it used to have a long-standing tradition, didn't it? I mean, there's always been the warmongers within it, but there's always a strong voice for peace and diplomacy. That seems to have completely disappeared now. And I mean, it's a bit different, I think, as I've already said, with regard to the cabinet led by Andy Burnham. But the fact that he's put John Healey in as Chancellor is not a great sign. And of course, Healey, I don't know, he made this speech, didn't he, to the Treasury officials, and he was setting out his priorities. But I mean, Richard Murphy, the economist, said he described John Healey as a man on a mission, but he said it was a man on a mission to fail because he's actually setting out the same failed economic agenda that we've had really for the last, getting on for 50 years. I mean, he's talked about, fiscal discipline being the key thing, and he's talked about, fiscal control, which essentially means not spending more than what's collected in taxes or sold off in government assets. And this is just not good, really. This is not. I mean, he said he wants to make life more affordable for people. He's all about backing Britain and wants growth in every post. But this ain't the right way to go about it. What we need is a big fiscal stimulus. I mean, not this talk about fiscal credibility. It's ridiculous. I mean, when you actually break it down, what they're talking about, the fiscal credibility. What it means is that really the smooth operation of the financial markets. I mean, this notion that somehow deficits are a bad thing, and that we should be, heading to a budget surplus. I mean, this is preposterous. I mean, there's been a government deficit. I was looking at this the other week actually, when I was. I'm not sure if it was I was responding to Tony Blair's essay or Andy Burnham's appearance on Newsnight, but I wrote a piece in response to both of those things, and I was doing a bit of research, looking at the how many times there's been a government surplus, which is what Rachel Reeves and now Healey seems to be arguing that we should be moving towards. And in the last 300 years, there's been a government deficit for 224 of those years, and since the war, there's only been 8 times that the government has been in surplus, from 1948 to 1951, I think it was, and from 1998 to 2000.
But not £3 trillion, Chris. This is getting crazy.
Well, no, look, the key thing isn't how much the government is spending. The key thing for government is, are they spending in a way which matches the ability of the economy to absorb that spend? And where are they spending it as well? Because, I mean, there's. The key thing really is the availability of real resources in the economy. I keep going on about this. This is where the left, I think, often falls down still, because they keep talking, many of them, about taxpayers' money. There is no such thing as taxpayers' money. When tax is paid, the money is destroyed. When the government spends, it simply issues an instruction to the Bank of England to spend whatever it is they want to spend. What the government does need to do, though, is to make sure that it's not spending beyond the ability of the economy to absorb that spending. And what I mean by that is not spending beyond the availability of real resources. And what do I mean by real resources? I'm talking about the availability of skilled workers, the availability of, plant and machinery, the availability of infrastructure, of access to energy, and so on and so forth. And what the government's focus should be on, I'm talking about this, is building up those real resources in the economy. And one of the other things I'm very passionate about right now is the need for the British economy to work towards becoming as self-sufficient as it possibly can be. Now, it's impossible for us to be completely self-sufficient, but there are many things I think that we could do a lot more of. And we think we could certainly be a lot more self-sufficient, maybe completely self-sufficient in food production, for example, in agriculture. And so we need to be, investing in those areas. And the reason why I say that is that this globalized agenda, this globalized economic agenda that the likes of, obviously Margaret Thatcher was in favor of, that was, Tony Blair, he was a big advocate, wasn't he? He still is a big advocate of this kind of globalized economy. Is that it leaves us very vulnerable to international crises. We've seen this, haven't we? With what's happened with the NATO proxy war in Ukraine, and the availability of cheap Russian gas no longer available. We've seen this with the impact of the illegal war that Israel and the United States have waged against Iran. And so we need, I think it seems to me, therefore, to be working towards a situation where we are as self-sufficient as we possibly can be. But I think we need to, get out of this notion that somehow the way in which the government funds its program is through taxing people and through so-called borrowing, which isn't really borrowing, actually. It's actually providing a blue chip, rock solid, safe savings account for the corporate sector and for for super rich oligarchs. Bill Mitchell, a well-known Australian economist, calls it corporate welfare. The sale of bonds. And often you hear, I mean, Andy Burnham was about this. He didn't want to upset the bond market, as if somehow, and this is really what's, a lot of what, is behind what John Healey is talking about, this notion of fiscal credibility. As I say, it's to facilitate the smooth operation of the financial markets, as if they are all powerful. They're not. They're absolutely reliant on the government. The government doesn't need to sell bonds. It doesn't need to sell bonds to obviously provision itself for the program of the spending that it wants to make. Because, as I've already said, it issues the currency. I mean, it does it really for a number of reasons, really. But it's done as a favor, if you like, really, to the financial markets, rather than something which is absolutely necessary to do. It's also beneficial. I mean, this is what tax, the main reason for taxation. And bond sales is that it removes liquidity from the economy, and that helps to bear down on inflation. Of course, the other reason for taxation is because it generates a demand for the currency, and therefore creates a value for the currency, because you have to pay your tax liabilities in pound sterling. No other domination will do. Denomination will do. It has to be paid in pound sterling. So these are the real reasons, and these are the sorts of arguments I would like to see the left actually embracing much more than it's been doing. Because this notion that somehow we pay for things through taxation, and we therefore need a wealth tax. We do need a wealth tax, but not to actually provide the resources for the government. We need to do a wealth tax to bear down on the power that these super rich individuals, the likes of Murdoch and various other perhaps less well-known individuals, the amount of power that that enormous wealth gives to them to actually, if you like, buy the political cast, to buy influence and so on, and to maintain their position. That's why we need a wealth tax. But by arguing on that, by the left arguing in that way, it sort of bestows a status on the billionaires, that somehow these people are essential to the delivery of a good society. That, if they were to up sticks and leave the country, if a socialist government ever did come to power, that we would then be impoverished and we wouldn't be able to do all these things. It's absolute nonsense. I mean, I made this point before, but when Alan Sugar, when Jeremy Corbyn was the leader of the Labour Party, said that if Corbyn got in, he would leave the country, I put out a statement saying, "Good, I'll drive you to the airport," because we don't need bumptious billionaires. We absolutely don't. In fact, if anything, they are a drain, and are they actually damage the the functioning of a good society. As I say, what we need, in my opinion, is a big fiscal stimulus, a commitment from the government to create a good society. To do all the things which are absolutely essential. I mean, John Healey talked about, he's going to back Britain, and he talked about wealth creation and making life more affordable and so on. But how's he going to do that if he's sticking to the fiscal rules? It's just not going to be possible.
Well,
And so
no,
what they
but
should be talking about is renationalising the utilities, removing the private sector from the public services, because they've been turned over to become a cash cow for the private sector. We should be talking about scrapping tuition fees, renewing our infrastructure, adapting to climate change, for example, by reforesting the upland. This would create huge numbers of jobs, a big house building program as well. Let's remember, back in the 1950s and 60s and 70s, during that post-war consensus period, we were building many years, well over 400,000 homes every single year. Now the ambition is to build 300,000. That seems, beyond the pale. And bear in mind, when we were building that sort of number, the population was considerably lower than it is today. On average, over that period from 1945, I think, through to 1981, we built on average, this is on average, sometimes it was higher, around 150,000 council houses every year. The number of council houses are being, actual council houses are being built last year, I think it was about 1,200. I mean, it's pathetic. And so these are the sort of things I think that John Healey should be talking about. That's his role as the Chancellor, to deliver full employment, to do these things, to actually make sure that you know, we can create this good society, not just kind of nonsense about, you know, balancing the books and, you know, fiscal credibility and all that kind of nonsense. That's just ridiculous. All that is doing is maintaining the status quo and smoothing the path, frankly, if we're not careful, you know, for a more extreme version of what we've got now in the form of reform. I mean, and they will, you know, go even further
But
than
look, you're right,
healing
absolutely
sometimes.
right about the left, Chris. I don't think they really do understand the way the financial system operates at the highest levels, and reform do. And of course, they're taking many, many votes, as we've seen over the last few years, and in the polls, from the left and from the Labour Party. So earlier this year, or maybe it was actually no, it was about this time last year, June. The 8th, 2025, Reform UK announced that it was Richard Tice, the deputy leader, wrote a scathing letter to Andrew Bailey, Governor of the Bank of England, slamming the bank's money printing scheme and outlining the strain and pressure the nation accounts are under. He said that paying interest on cash in the bank, as well as selling government bonds at a loss, is a systemic misuse of taxpayers' money. Reform is claiming that it could save the country around about £35 billion a year by getting rid of interest on central bank reserves, which is part of the Bank of England's quantitative easing programme, created in big inverted commas to boost the economy. Farage's party say they would use the money saved from cutting the scheme to pay for an increase in tax-free personal allowance up to £20,000. So these sorts of, should we say, macroeconomic changes, talking to the Bank of England, getting the Bank of England to do what the government wants it to do, rather than the bank just saying, "Oh, we have to be independent." Reformers seem to be on the case, and one does wonder if actually this is going to be a very difficult act for the left to beat, completely almost impossible, if they are also doing these making these suggestions that the Labour Party are really challenging this whole neoliberal model, which nobody else seems to be.
Yeah, I mean, but the reform aren't challenging the neoliberal model. I mean, you know, the Breton clock is right twice a day, and they're partly right, but they're also significantly wrong in what they were saying there. Yes, of course, why on earth are we paying, you know, the interest on those bank reserves? It was created, actually, as you said, through the quantitative easing process. But then to say, oh, we're going to use the savings in order to fund, you know, an increase in the personal taxation lines. I mean, it's a good kind of political line, and it sort of kind of make common sense. But as I've already said, that isn't how it works. When the government wants to spend or do anything, they just issue an instruction to the Bank of England to release the money. So, you know, I don't accept that premise that they are putting forward. Yes, we should increase the, you know, the personal allowance. I'm all for that. I'm all for, you know, making sure that, you know, people on, you know, on average incomes, if you like, or lower incomes, pay up, you know, should be paying less taxes, should be a higher, you know, the threat tax threshold should be higher. The key thing is, I keep coming back to, when the government wants to spend, it just issues the instruction to the Bank of England. It taxes in order to withdraw money from the economy to make sure there isn't too much liquidity in the economy, because when that happens, that creates inflation. And that's what we need to be mindful about. Not, you know. So yeah, I mean, it's a good line, and you know, it sounds plausible, but it's a load of nonsense what reform is. Apart from the fact that they're absolutely right that we shouldn't be paying interest on those bank reserves that were created from the quantitative easing process all those years ago. I mean, it's I know I don't know, mate, but yeah, it's ridiculous, and you know, we on the left really need to get our act together, it seems to
Well,
me,
this is what bothers
and under.
me, is the only people that seem to be to understand how the money system, the creation of money system and interest really works, and the Bank of England and the private banking sector seems to be the right. You know, that's the it frustrates me. But anyway, look,
Well, I'm
let's
not,
just.
I'm not sure how much they do understand it. I mean, from what, if that's what Reform genuinely believe, well, that's a load of nonsense. That
What I'm
isn't an
talking about
understanding
is
of it.
parties that stand a chance of actually winning in a general election
Yeah,
or
no,
getting a
absolutely. I
large
mean,
majority or whatever.
we've got to give people hope and give people a reason to vote. I mean, and I think we had a chance with Jeremy Corbyn. We saw the biggest increase in vote share for the Labour Party since 1945, when we went into that election in 2017, and people were predicting a catastrophic result for the Labour Party. The Labour Party didn't win it, I accept that, but it did, as I've already said, put on a big increase in its in the number of people voting for it. And actually, I mean, I made this point to Jeremy and others, that that was the best result that the Labour Party could have hoped for, because had we won that election, I say we, I'm no longer a member, the part of the Labour Party, it's difficult to get out of that habit. I was in the party for 44 years, but had the Labour Party won that election with the MPs that were in the Parliamentary Labour Party at that time, it would have been almost impossible to deliver the agenda that Corbyn was heading up, you know, in the manifesto, you know, bringing the utilities into public ownership, scrapping tuition fees and all the rest of it. There would have been huge resistance, I think, from a lot of those right-wing MPs who were in the Parliamentary Labour Party at that time. The situation now in terms of the Parliamentary Labour Party is considerably worse than it was when Jeremy Corbyn was a leader. And this is why, you know, I wanted to make sure, you know, we have this democratisation agenda with open selections for MPs. And this would have, you know, rather than Peter Mandelson and Morgan McSweeney screening out, you know, good people from being potential candidates, it would have been the grassroots members that would have made those
I mean, do
decisions.
you
And so
think under Burnham we might start to see some of the people like yourself who are expelled, welcome back into the Labour Party?
I think it's highly unlikely. I don't think even if he wanted to, that he would not be able to, you know, get that past the, you know, the people, the powers that be, if you like, within the party and outside the party, wield huge influence over the party. You know, don't forget that still a large number of people in the Parliamentary Labour Party are signed up members of the Labour Friends of Israel. Andy Burnham himself, for example, was a member of that. And, you know, the Zionist lobby does hold, you know, huge influence over the Labour Party. And they wouldn't tolerate the likes of, you know, Jeremy Corbyn, myself, or others being invited back into the party, even if he wanted to do it. And I'm not sure he would. And even if he did, I'm not sure many of us would actually accept the offer. It would, in my opinion, be a, you know, a poisoned chalice. Because I think, I mean, if I'm honest with you, Tony, I think the best thing that can happen is for the Labour Party to be destroyed. Now, that might mean going through some even greater pain than what we're going through at the moment, with the potentiality of a reform government coming to power. But we need to build a better alternative, it seems to me, than what we've already got. One of the good things that might come out of a Burnham leadership, having said all this, of course, is if we can get electoral reform. And that would be transformational. And I know it's a kind of constitutional thing, and some people might think, oh, that's a bit dry and so on. But, you know, as far as democracy is concerned, and delivering that good society, it would be so much easier to achieve that, because it would enable, you know, other parties of the left, and for that matter, of the right, actually. But it would enable smaller parties to get a representation. And yes, you know, you'll be talking about coalition government, but at the minute you've kind of got a coalition, but it's forced in, or it has been anyway in the past, and you know, maybe Reform are breaking this mold now, and possibly the Green Party as well, actually. But this coalition was forced into the two main parties. So this is why you had, you know, you've got the, on the one hand, for example, you know, you've got the likes of Tony Benn in the Labour Party back in the day, and then you'd also got, you know, very right wing figures like you know, Dennis Healey, and although I suspect Dennis Healey, with the sort of policies he was pursuing, would probably be considered a raving left winger by the modern standards of the Labour Party. But you know, so it forced people into this party, and the same was true with the Conservative Party as well. And so that would be one really good thing, I think, that if Andy Burnham does hold true to that commitment, and he said he did want to bring about electoral reform, but then I'm not sure if I heard him say that he wouldn't do it ahead of an election. It would have to get, you know, a buy-in from the electorate in a
Now,
general
also, I
election.
mean, in his first week, Burnham has been a bit of a shot across his bows from Iran, saying that Britain is a legitimate target now. The bombers have been taking off, the US Air Force bombers from USAF stroke RAF Fairford here in Gloucestershire, and bombing Iran. And Iran is saying anybody that's facilitating this war against us The Gulf states have obviously already come under quite a significant attack, as well as the Israelis. The Iranians are now saying, well, if you're going to help the Americans to bomb us, then you're a legitimate target now. I wonder what you make of that, Chris, and how Andy Burnham is going to react, because we didn't really have those sorts of direct announcements made against Starmer.
No, indeed. And the fact that he's given that green light for the USAF to use British air bases, I think is a very retrograde step and actually does imperil the nation. I mean, Healey was talking about defense of the realm and all the rest of it. This is not defending Britain. It's not defending the national interest at all. I mean, that's one of the reasons I would like to see is coming out of NATO. NATO is not a defensive military alliance. It's an aggressive military alliance, which actually, I think, makes us far less safe rather than making us safer. And I think what we should be looking towards is building links with diplomatic ties and economic ties, with the BRICS nations, move away from the G7, move away from the orbit of the United States of America. I mean that the U.S. empire, it seems to me, is in its death throes, and we're seeing the rise of the multipolar world. We're seeing the rise of what is now an economic giant in the form of China, of course, and there are other developing countries which are, more and bigger important players now than they ever were on the international scene. And we need to be, in my opinion, making links with those
But is it
nations.
possible for a British Prime Minister these days to say to the Americans, no, you can't use our air base? I mean, are we talking about turning off the power? Are we talking about potentially British troops going onto a US air base and making it impossible for them to take off, this sort of thing? Because the Americans, it seems, just do what they want to do, and they don't take any notice of a British Prime Minister nowadays.
Well, I don't think, to be fair, the British Prime Minister's ever kind of put that to them, have they, really? But I do think it's possible. It just takes
Well,
political
Starmer did.
will.
He said they're not going to be using British bases.
Yeah, but then he said they're not, and then they were, and then they did. I mean, he kind of backtracked on that, didn't he? In my estimation, I think, of what happened. I think certainly in terms of the situation with regard to Palestine and initially the situation, the illegal war against Iran. He then, I mean, they made up the cock and bull story, and it was kind of for defensive purposes. I mean, I think
Yeah,
this is what Andy
defensive
Burnham is.
bombing. I mean, this
Well, I
is
mean, it's absurd. I mean, it's kind of Orwellian, isn't it?
like
It's
this
ridiculous.
collateral damage term, these things. Anyway, look, I'd just like to wind up, Chris, by asking, I can't not ask you really about the horrific death of Anne Widdecombe, obviously on the other side politically, but I wondered if you have ever had any encounters, meetings with Anne, and what you make of the political fallout from this, because it actually might well be a good thing electorally for reform. And a lot of people think this is horrifying. We just had Nigel Farage the day before talking about death threats to him, and then suddenly the next day, one of his chief lieutenants, one of the most experienced people, the highest levels in reform and the justice spokesperson for reform, is murdered. I mean, it's pretty shocking.
Shocking and horrific, of course, and it's appalling when anybody is murdered, and we've seen a number of relatively high profile politicians in recent years who've been murdered. Joe Cox and David Amos. I knew David Amos actually, he was conservative, but I got on with him quite well actually. I mean, on some issues, we had very similar views. I mean, he was very concerned about animal rights, animal welfare, and we shared a passion on that particular issue. We worked together on fire and rescue issues and fire safety. I was on some committees with him, and got on with him quite well. And it was appalling when he was murdered. And and the murder of Anne Widdecombe again, similarly, was, from what I've heard anyway, it was a pretty horrific, brutal attack that she was subjected to. I mean, of course, she was a controversial figure. I mean, I remember when she was a prisons minister and sanctioning the chaining of of pregnant women while they were in labor, prisoners who were expecting a child when they went into labor. They were still shackled, and she sort of sanctioned some of that. So she was definitely a controversial figure. It's always, I find it a bit odd, really, that some of these high profile politicians claim to be religious. I mean, the same with Tony Blair, isn't it? I think and Whittaker also was a religious person, and was a Catholic, and I don't know how they square that really with some of the policies that they embrace, and
Well,
having said that, of course,
the
I wouldn't want to
illegal
see any.
invasion of Iraq, for
Well,
example, which
exactly. I
voted
mean, you
for.
know, I mean, there's, you know, there is, the Ten Commandment, that Ten Commandments, thou shalt not kill. Is it the fourth commandment? I can't just recall. Actually, I mean, I'm a lapsed Catholic myself, actually, so I should know these things off by heart. But I always find it a bit odd, that people who profess to be Christians and, that they are among, some of them anyway, among the chief warmongers. But no, I mean, look, I mean, absolutely appalling what happened to and Widdicombe, and you wouldn't wish that on anybody. And it's a sad reflection, I think, of our sick society, frankly, and it's where the policies that have been pursued for the last 50 years can end up leading. It kind of builds this kind of, I mean, who knows? I don't know what the reasons are, but I think, it can build resentment, I mean, and there is no need for people to be struggling in this country. We are a wealthy country, the fifth biggest economy in the world. We could eliminate poverty in Britain. We should have eliminated poverty in Britain. Never mind, just ending street homelessness. And that's a worthy ambition that Andy Burnham has set out. It's something that Jeremy Corbyn himself was also very passionate about, but that's the minimum that we should be doing. We should be eliminating poverty altogether. We should have a good society with full employment and functioning public services and an infrastructure which is fit for purpose. You can't drive down a street now, particularly in the country lanes, without hitting potholes. I mean, it's a shocking state of affairs that the quality of our infrastructure and the lack of hope that there is there for lots of people, large sections of our communities are have this sense of hopelessness, and that's completely wrong. And we need to be addressing that. And
Well, I mean, Andy Burnham does seem to have at least given out a few signals that the Labour Party is returning a little bit back to its roots from the Starmer years. So maybe there will be a little. I think we as individuals, we always, I think, like to give people the benefit of the doubt. So let's see how Mr. Burnham gets on, Chris. And maybe you could just remind us about your how people can find and follow you online and the Workers' Party.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, you just look at the Works Party, Works Party of Britain. I mean, they're on all of the social media platforms. I'm on Facebook, just as Chris Williamson. If you look for that, you should be able to find me on X, formerly Twitter. I'm down as Derby Chris W, at Derby Chris W, and you can follow me there. I put quite a bit of content onto that platform, and I also host a program called Palestine Declassified once a week. So look out for that as well.
Okay, Chris Williamson, thanks very much for joining us.
Cheers.